Welcome to the Podium and Panel Podcast.
Good afternoon, Your Honors.
What's at the end of this case? How did this come about? Are you in the pay of the Microsoft Corporation?
Sure, with the text of the Second Amendment.
Your Honor, I think that could be viewed as political, that would be...
How about the First Amendment?
No, Your Honor, I don't think the First Amendment...
You're out again. Still out.
I think we're all textual.
Welcome to episode 199 of the Podium and Panel Podcast. Yes, next Sunday will be 200 episodes. The first case today is from the California Supreme Court, Another Planet Entertainment, LLC versus Vigilant Insurance Company, a business interruption case. The second is from the Illinois Appellate Second District, McLeod versus Commonwealth Edison. We'll talk about that case. It was decided, but we felt it was an important enough case to still talk about it. And a third is from the Supreme Court of the United States, Truck Insurance versus Kaiser Gypsum. Turning to our first case, California is the last major state to have arguments set on whether there is business interruption coverage arising under COVID-19. The court recently held argument in California Supreme Court and Another Planet Entertainment LLC versus Vigilant Insurance Company. The court is considering the following certified question from the Ninth Circuit. Can the actual or potential presence of the COVID-19 virus on an insured's premises constitute direct physical loss or damage to property for purposes of coverage under commercial property insurance policy? Pat, tell us about this case.
Thanks, Dan. And we've referenced that California has a whole lot of cases percolating both in its own system and from the Ninth Circuit. And the case that it took, at least initially, is a certified question. And this certified question is very, very interesting. Couple things. It took us a little bit to get to this because it takes a little while for California apparently to post the arguments. But when they do post the arguments, they post them in video form, and you download the thing. And when it shows up, it's the entire video file of the argument for the day, which was 7 hours, which meant I thought I was getting into having to watch 7 hours of oral argument about this. And I said, that seems a bit much. Fortunately, it was under an hour, but the video file was over, you know, like 2 gigabytes or something. my computer may not have been happy.
Probably
this
not.
This question is very interesting because it frames the argument, but it does it so in an important way. Dan read it, but I'll read part of it again. Can the actual or potential presence? So they really talked about, they got pretty far into what the science as it's pled. As these arguments have gone on, and maybe this is the wisdom of the California Supreme Court having waited to take these cases, the pleading has gotten extremely advanced, as I think everybody has experienced as a lawyer. As you go through it, if you have a series of arguments on a topic, it takes a long time for the arguments to fully get fleshed out. You know, an opening brief, a response, and a reply sometimes isn't enough. It takes, you know, you have several cases on the same topic and you're talking back to each other, responding. Your opening brief gets tailored to what you know is going to come back in the response. The response then gets beefed up, and then the reply gets beefed up, and the argument evolves over time. We've certainly, as an example in Illinois, we've seen that happen in the stacking context. We've seen it happen in the notice context. We've seen it happen in the cooperation context, and obviously well outside the insurance context as well. And in this case, the plaintiffs, the insureds are taking the position that the property is physically changed by the presence of the virus, and that it attaches to surfaces, it makes them a fomite, this idea. And let's say, Dan, maybe you heard it differently, but it didn't seem the court was buying this.
It did not.
Among the questions that the party for the insurer, the lawyer for the insured got was, well, how is this different than the flu? You know, we've had the flu for a long time. People get the flu. The flu's on surfaces. Why is the flu different? Then there's arguments about, well, it changes the air. And there's case law, apparently, that it doesn't change the air. Or you don't own the air, rather. And that kind of makes sense. The air comes in and out. The air is not not a fixed. There's not a fixed set of air within the situation. I use the word situation in the way that Richard Epstein uses the word situation. That is all the time in every context. If you listen to his podcast, you should have a drinking game on the word situation. By the end of the half hour, you'll be falling over drunk. But he uses the word a lot. It's very interesting. Anyway, that's a word we use a lot. I commend the argument to people that are really following this. There's California. There's obviously a tremendous amount of business. There's 40 some million people. There's a lot at stake here, and it's not over. It's over in a lot of other places. It never really began in Illinois, at least at the highest court. The lower courts, the lower appellate courts, have half a dozen or so, a couple dozen decisions. Same thing with the Seventh Circuit, most of the other circuits. This argument seemed to be going that same way, distinguishing the cat urine cases, the carbon monoxide cases, the asbestos cases, all the cases we've heard about. But also it's important that this question only focuses on the insuring agreement, not any exclusions or other things. It doesn't focus on the restoration provision. It doesn't focus on any of these other issues that may inform, to an extent, the insuring agreement. It focuses only on the insuring agreement and what the plaintiffs can actually plead. Dan, what are your thoughts?
I agree with you, Pat, and it doesn't get to the exclusions or endorsements, so it's an important question for California. And we talked. I mean, the one thing I think that was a bit surprising, I think, when you mentioned the cat urine cases and ammonia cases, those are very similar. You wipe it off. There was no replacement of equipment in those cases. You shut down. You air it out. So here, I guess, the argument might be a little bit different. But in any event,
I think that it physically. I think the ammonia physically changes the drywall. The porous surfaces.
Now, in that case, if you read the case from the Northern District of New Jersey that had the ammonia, they shut down the production because it was refrigerant that got out, and they didn't replace any equipment or anything. So
okay, yeah. The cat urine case, though, they did, didn't they?
they may have. I don't know.
Was it like drywall or something?
Yeah, maybe.
And so that was physical damage. That was a physical alteration if you're having to replace drywall.
Yeah. But there, there's dust cases, and in any event, it didn't sound like this court was buying it, and it was a bit surprising, I guess, that the court actually took a certified question, because they'd had some opportunities in the past for various questions, I believe, Pat, and hadn't taken up on any of the referrals for certification, but in this case, probably a good idea so they could finally put to rest, I think, the issue. And I think with this, unless it comes out differently than it sounds like it might, I'm not sure that there's any other jurisdictions that are still struggling with this. I think it's...
Well, you have Vermont.
Vermont
was the run court that remanded the matter. And that's really what the plaintiffs are asking for, is to get a remand.
Right. To actually get into some discovery and other things, right? And so,
right. And that's one thing I didn't. It's like, well, we wanted the discovery to be able to prove this. It's like, well you've pled the hell out of it. You've
right.
pled all these things. And the courts, like, they're criticizing a lot of the plaintiff side or insured side's lawyers are like, well, the court's doing science. It's like, no, you've pled all the things you can plead. And they
right.
looked at it and say, let's suppose all that's true, because they have to take it as true because it's on a motion to dismiss.
Right.
Say, well, that's
is it
not,
sufficient, right?
Is that sufficient? They've seen it all at this point. What else would you can plead anything you want. You just
right.
haven't gotten to where it's enough. So,
yeah,
maybe it will be. We'll see. It's California. No one
it's California. Although California, as you and I've talked about, I think in some other areas in insurance has been not as policyholder friendly, I guess I would say, as you know, back in the Montrose days with the pollution exclusions and other developments in California over the years. So it'll be interesting to see what the California Supreme Court does with this certified question.
Exactly. All right. So with that, we'll take our first break and come back with a decided case, but a really important one. McLeod versus Comet.
Hey, Podiumin Podcast listeners. If you want to get in touch with the show, you can drop us a line at podiumandpanelpodcast@gmail.com. Please let us know about cases you're interested in or guests you'd like us to interview. You can also follow Dan and I on LinkedIn, as well as the Podium and Panel Podcast page on LinkedIn. We look forward to hearing from you.
Welcome back to episode 199 of the Podium and Panel Podcast, segment two, and Canada Utility, who is alleged to have bribed the most powerful public official in a state government to secure favorable treatment, be sued in equity for an accounting and disgorgement. That is the question that was answered by the Illinois Appellate Court, 2nd District, in McLeod versus Commonwealth. The plaintiff alleges that ComEd bribed former Speaker Mike Madigan to obtain the passage of two bills that it yielded approximately $1.7 billion, that's billion with a B, in excess rates. That's what was said at oral argument. Almost as important as his role as Speaker, Madigan was the head of the Illinois Democrat Party and in charge of selecting politically appointed officials. The defendants argue that the plaintiff's claims are void under the filed rate doctrine, separation of powers doctrine, the lack of an allegation of causation, the independence of the Senate from the House, and the legislation returning $31 million to, that's million with an M, million dollars to ratepayers like Dan and I after the corruption came to light. Dan, tell us about this case and the opinion that came out before we could talk about it. But
yeah.
Even though we had a case we could have substituted in, we still decided to talk about it because this is the first one that's had oral argument. There was a case in the first district that didn't have oral argument that I recall.
Yeah.
And we didn't talk about it, but this one had oral argument. And so that's why we're going to talk about it. And so we're going to talk about it. Dan, go ahead.
Sure. And so for people that aren't familiar with Illinois politics, Michael Madigan was in the House of Representatives for 40 plus years. He was the Speaker of the House for 35 plus years, I believe.
With a 2-year interregnum in the mid 90s following the 94 Republican wave.
Right.
And he wasn't Speaker for those 2 years, but he was Speaker of the House for nearly four decades.
And what's important here is as Pat said, Madigan was not just Speaker of the House, but he was chair of the Democratic Party, a very influential, probably one of the most influential Congress people at any state or the federal level. Maybe
it's the most powerful politician in the country.
Yeah,
You can't overstate the amount of power that he had.
No, and you know, he was in the House. We're bicameral in Illinois, like most states other than Nebraska. The one of the justices at one time tried to you know, get back to this question of his power and asked the advocates, are you arguing that the Senate is not a separate entity? But again, if for those that really were involved or knew anything about Illinois politics, and we should note as well, Pat, that Madigan has been indicted. He's awaiting trial. I believe it's in 2025 now. It's after the elections. His compatriots have been convicted. The folks that were at ComEd and other places have been convicted. ComEd had entered into a deferred prosecution agreement. Thank you. Paid $200 million. And what happened in this case and the decision that Pat's referring to is that this court held that ComEd, you know, the proximate cause chain is not here in terms of the bribe resulting in massive amounts of ongoing rate increases that taxpayers in city of Chicago pay to ComEd, which is our main electric utility provider.
Our only electric utility in Northern Illinois.
Yeah, I think, you know, you can do some of these other third-party services, but they're kind of bogus. Not bogus, but they overlay because, like you said, Pat, the meters into our houses, the pipelines, everything is wired into ComEd, just like people's gas. You can have alternatives, but really doesn't. I don't think it saves people money, and not many people I think have ever done the move just because it doesn't make any sense. But this was the second district. So this is second district again, is the Skokie kind of right north side and northwest.
No, well, Skokie's in Cook, but this is Lake County. This case came out of Lake County.
That's right. I apologize for that. So it came out of Lake County. And one of the things that they were asking about was the sufficiency for how bills get passed. And I'd relay to Pat, when my oldest was in eighth grade, right before that, a couple months before, the Chicago Bar Association does international COE trips. And we went on a trip to Rome. And Speaker Madigan was there with one of his daughters, not Lisa, who was the Attorney General of Illinois at some point, but his other daughter and his son. And there was a strike in Rome on that Saturday. We were walking around. I believe it was a Saturday, the day before we were going home. So we figured out how to get a golf cart, and my wife and I were there, and the Madigans were able to, I said, you know, just get on the thing with us. And so dropped him off at his hotel, wherever he was staying. And then I said, I'm going to be in Springfield in a couple of weeks. And he said, oh, what's going on? I said, my eighth grader's doing a trip to Springfield. So he gave his card with his assistant's name, and we went down to Springfield and in the lobby of the Capitol. My friend who was down there, who was a legislative aide to the House, he came and got us, and he was talking about the special tour we were going on, and a bunch of people not related to the eighth graders glommed onto the trip. We go up to Madigan's chambers, and he gave a very, very interesting presentation to these eighth graders and other parents and me and the other chaperones about how powerful of a speaker he was and how bills, that there's 10 ways that bills can die or 9 ways that bills can die and only one way that bills get approved, including going through the Rules Committee. And again, he was in the House, but in those days, any plum assignments, any kind of, you know, the reality was, is he controlled kind of both chambers indirectly. And as Pat said, you know, maybe it wasn't pleaded here. That wasn't the issue, his other hat. But a lot of the questions, again, and it seemed to be a lot of skepticism, I'd say, Pat, on the side of some of the justices about, again, this, whether there was this a relationship, the introduction of the bill calling for the vote, whether that was a cause and fact, that was part of the causal chain. The advocate for the petitioners here talked about a domino chain flick, and if you set in motion the dominoes and they keep falling, that you can establish this causal connection. As Pat said, the decision came out fairly quickly. As we've talked about in the past, the second district is often very quick with their decisions. And in this one, it appears as if there will not be any justice. I can't imagine if this were appealed to the Supreme Court of Illinois, Pat, we may get a similar recusal to what happened.
I was thinking the same thing.
Right? What happened in the Alderman Burke that we talked about recently, where Alderman Burke is married to the former Chief Justice of Illinois Supreme Court. And many of the Democrats in Cook County and throughout the state are beneficiaries of the Madigan kind of running of government, and it's starting to change some, I think, you know, now that he's been out several years, and but there's still kind of a flavor of that. And so this case may get appealed to the Illinois Supreme Court, but I don't know that, like I said, I don't know that PLA would be granted just because of the politics. If, and again, I don't know if they would recuse or not,
The other one, the PLA was denied.
Yeah.
Let me put some more meat on the bone to what Dan is saying.
Yeah, please.
I've been involved somewhat directly, but mostly tangentially to the legislative process, such as it was under Madigan and such as it is currently. And let's just say it's night and day in terms of how things work. I'll give two examples. And Dan's reference to Alderman Burke is also helpful. We'll mention that too. So I remember being in a representative's office who was sympathetic to the arguments we were making and on a particular bill. And he said, yeah, I get what you're saying, but I'm going to do this anyway because I want to keep my job. And what did he mean by that? Well, what he meant by that was just ask Ken Duncan. So Ken Duncan was my representative in downtown Chicago, and he sided with Bruce Rauner, who was a Republican governor, on a couple of issues and thwarted Madigan on a couple of things. So Madigan primaried him with the current, who is now the lieutenant governor, Stratton, and spent millions of dollars on a state House representative primary. Rauner also funded Duncan. There was like $6 million spent on a House primary. I was getting mail every single day from both of them. TV ads, radio ads, a radio ad from the then sitting president, Barack Obama, recorded a radio ad to support a primary representative. This is the power that Madigan had. And that was what people knew, that if they crossed him, that was what was going to happen to you. So Dan, so those are two examples, you know, both, you know, one private, one extraordinarily public, And so there were several arguments that the justices made. And said, well, they're Republican, and they did an argument, well, they're Republican legislators. Well, if the Republicans wanted anything done, they would get primary too. Madigan had so much money because he has they have the public sector unions and the private sector unions too. But you know who the executive director is, or was at least, of ITLA, their second largest donor? It's his former chief of staff. So
yeah.
So he controlled the river of money, and river, I don't use that as a pejorative, but he controls all of the money going everywhere, coming into the Democrat Party, going out of the Democrat Party. And so you understand what Burke got convicted of. Burke had a very similar scam. It's what it is, to how Madigan ran his private business. So Burke and Madigan were both in the business of property tax appeals. Who picked the members of the property tax board? Madigan. And then his lawyers would appear in front of the very board that he picked. And how are property tax appeals? How do you get compensated for a property tax appeal? You're paid on a third of what you save. You can't make this kind of graft up.
And even better is Burke at the city level, Madigan at the state level, as finance chairs. And oversight of the finance set the budget for how much taxes had to be collected. So, and then give large, the Trump Tower and other assessments and every big building in downtown Chicago, as well as residential. It all became just this, like you said, a kind of spinning wheel. And it's
but that's what we're dealing with. That's the kind of corruption that we're dealing with here.
And it's not just you mentioned that Republicans could be primaried, Pat, but I've been involved in campaigns and have heard many stories over the years of Democrats being primaried.
Well, that's what Ken Duncan was. Ken Duncan was primaried by a Democrat.
If there's an incumbent and somebody that actually might be a better fit for, you know, sound government and actually represent the people better, the amount of money that would be sent and foot soldiers to, you know, make sure that that person got clobbered and, you know, postcards with footnotes that made no reference to anything legit, but the voters would do that. There was a couple of cases, I don't remember if Pat, but in one race, the bright idea was to split the vote and have somebody with the exact same name in a Latino community be also on a ballot and confuse voters, right? So vote for so-and-so. And just a lot of this. Yeah, that's what we're dealing with. And I don't think people really understand the history of Illinois. I mean, it's not some state that you think, well, that's where corruption is king. It's not the Huey Long, you know, concept of Louisiana or, you know, in the swamps. This is the swamps of Midwest state.
This is much worse.
It is.
Much worse. So what's happening now that Madigan is not in charge is that it's the Wild West in terms of the bills that are available. And so it's very hard to figure. There's so many more bills that are coming both in the House and the Senate because he would put a brick on stuff. Legislators had 3, maybe 5 bills. That was all they were allowed to have. Now they've got, you know, oodles. And maybe that's better and maybe it's worse, but it's sure hard to figure out what's going on.
Right. Very hard.
Much more. Our list of bills to monitor, you know, is going up substantially. It doesn't mean they're all moving. It just means that they're different. So,
yep.
All right. So, a very frustrating decision. And
I think though, if we had predicted, I think we would have predicted how this came out. But
oh, sure, no doubt.
Yeah,
we're not going to put it in the black. We're not going to put it on the score sheet. But
no,
it a really important and frustrating decision.
Very
so
much.
With that, we'll take our next break and come back with a case from the Supreme Court of the United States: truck insurance versus Kaiser Gypsum.
Hey, Podiumin Podcast listeners. If you want to get in touch with the show, you can drop us a line at podiumandpanelpodcast@gmail.com. Please let us know about cases you're interested in or guests you'd like us to interview. You can also follow Dan and I on LinkedIn, as well as the Podium and Panel Podcast page on LinkedIn. We look forward to hearing from you.
We're back for segment 3 of episode 199 of the Podium and Panel Podcast. Turning to our final case, with the importance of mass tort litigation, the use of bankruptcy as a process to resolve such matters, and the proliferation of claims being made because of increased advertising funded by third-party litigation, the decision from the Supreme Court of the United States in truck insurance versus Kaiser Gypsum will be very important. The question presented is an insurer with financial responsibility for a bankruptcy claim a party in interest that may object to a plan of reorganization under Chapter 11 of the Bankruptcy Code? Oye described the case thusly. Section 524G of the Bankruptcy Code, part of the Bankruptcy Reform Act of 1994, allows a Chapter 11 debtor with significant asbestos liabilities to channel all current and future asbestos claims into a trust funded by the debtor. In the face of over 38,000 asbestos-related lawsuits since 1978, Kaiser Gypsum Company, Inc., and Hansen Permanente Cement, Inc., collectively known as the debtors, filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy in 2016. As part of their proposed reorganization plan, the debtors negotiated with multiple parties, including insurance companies, creditors, government agencies, and representatives of both current and future asbestos claimants, to establish a 524G trust. This trust aimed to channel both existing and future asbestos-related claims away from the debtors. The trust's financial viability heavily dependent on primary liability insurance policies issued by Truck Insurance Exchange between the 1960s and 1980s, which obligated Truck to investigate and defend each asbestos claim against the debtors up to a per-claim limit of $500,000. The debtors would assign their rights under these Truck policies to the 524G Trust as part of the plan's funding. Truck opposed the plan, arguing it failed to provide anti-fraud measures for insured claims that would be litigated in the tort system, thereby potentially exposing Truck to fraudulent claims. Despite Truck's objections, the bankruptcy court recommended confirmation of the plan, finding it to be insurance neutral and therefore not impacting Truck's rights or obligations under the existing policies. The district court upheld this decision, confirming the plan and thereby nullifying Truck's objections. Importantly, 100% of the asbestos personal injury claimants had approved the proposed plan, making Truck the sole objector. The district court confirmed the plan over Truck's objections, finding Truck lacked standing to challenge the plan because it was not a party in interest under 1109B. The U.S. Circuit Court for the Fourth Circuit affirmed. Pat, tell us about this case.
Thanks, Dan. And this is part of the subject of my column this week in the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin, or a related issue, as well as going to be our rule of the week related to MDLs. Now, this isn't an MDL, but it is a mass tort situation. And a lot of these we've talked about, I think, in the Purdue Pharma situation, where you try to use bankruptcy as a vehicle to try to settle these kinds of issues. And in one of the cases I'm going to talk about in my column next week is an MDL down in the Southern District of Illinois, where it's the Paraquat MDL. And in that case, they're claiming the plaintiffs are that Paraquat caused Parkinson's. But as the court has ordered a limited amount of discovery, what those cases where discovery has been ordered, some of them have been voluntarily dismissed because these people have testified that they were exposed to Paraquat in forms it was never sold in, or they didn't actually have medical records that showed that they ever even developed Parkinson's disease, and so on. So you get the idea. And so these anti-fraud protections are really important, because if you heard what Dan said, the obligation of Truck is is a per claim limit of $500,000, which means that if you have 100 claims and 50 of them are fake, then that's 50 times 500,000 that is potentially off the table that Truck has to pay. Whereas if all 100 are legitimate, they all caused what's the mesothelioma. The mesothelioma death rate is 80, 90, it's an extraordinarily high percentage. It's in the Ebola range or pancreatic cancer range of death sentence. Not 100%, but very close. And so you're now talking about $500,000 a pop at 100 for 100 claimants. Well, you could understand why they have an interest in having fraud protections, because you can't go on television without seeing somebody saying, have you been caused by some disease, by some exposure to something, whether it is the Camp Lejeune, which obviously isn't this, or asbestos, or vaginal mesh, or you name the drug, it's going to turn into one of these advertisements, and that money to run all these and to run up all of these claimants. And there's the vetting process, let's just say, on the plaintiff's side, in many cases, is not very strong. Now, sometimes it is, but sometimes it isn't. And the purpose of the adversarial process is to figure out which ones are legit and which ones are not. And I fail to understand how the insurance company exposed in this way. Now, if they just had a pot of money, let's suppose they had $10 million policies for this group of years, and they were, then that might be a different situation. But even then, maybe there were no exposures during that year. Maybe there were no, unlikely. Or maybe there were no, maybe the claimants, still you need fraud protections. People should have to prove up what their claim is. They should have to prove they had the disease, whether, and we're dealing with asbestos. We're not just dealing with mesothelioma. We're dealing with some varieties of lung cancer. We're also dealing with asbestosis. So there's a variety of disease processes that can be developed from asbestos exposure, and the plaintiff should have to prove that up. Now, if they do, okay, then we're in a different world. But they should have to prove it up. And simply because it becomes a mass tort doesn't mean that the defendants automatically have to start writing checks. The bankruptcy, obviously the debtors are a big fan of this because it gets them off their books. The creditors, the claimants, obviously are fans of this. They're going to get the money. The insurance company not having the finding that they don't have standing seems to me just shocking how they could not have standing, but because they're the ones writing the checks and their liability is limited per the whether this claim is actually or this whether there actually is even a claim that's legitimate. Maybe it is, okay, but there should be some protections to determine if it is, and that's what this is about. And so we'll see if an insurance company can intervene or object in this fashion. Dan, what are your thoughts?
Thanks, Pat. And if you listen to this argument, I think that I think our predictions will be that the court seems skeptical of the arguments that somehow the insurer in this case is not doesn't have some interest in this case. I think Amy Coney Barrett, some of her questions. I think Gorsuch, I think Kagan was very skeptical. And for a step back, if you've heard the word Kaiser or Permanente, there was an industrialist out in Oakland, California, Henry J. Kaiser. He started not only the aluminum company and the gypsum company and Permanente cement company, but he also started Kaiser Permanente, which is an integrated managed care consortium. It has a health plan. It has hospitals and medical
giant
groups.
California giant, health plan.
Giant. In fact, one of my former colleagues from Lord Bissell days moved out there, and I'm not sure if he's still there, but he went in-house there. And they also have a giant credit union that... I know that from my days when I was on the advisory board of Alliance Credit Union. They merged or acquired Kaiser Permanente. But in any event,
these people know how to make money.
They do. They do. And he made a lot of money. He had aluminum companies. He had gypsum. He had all kinds of stuff. If it was construction in California... And in Northern California, for sure, more than likely in the 30s and 40s, this guy was involved and this company was involved. But like I said, the justices here were really trying to figure out, the government spoke and the petitioner spoke, really just variations or narrow differences on their approaches. And respondents in this case, at one point they asked about if he was objecting to this fraud piece, Pat, and then I think it was Kavanaugh said, you just don't want them to be heard. And Kagan almost channeled Breyer at one point, I think, in the respondents' advocacy. She kind of gave a long speech really about her views on things and was asking and trying to get I think the respondent counsel to concede on a few points, and he wasn't having any of it. But an interesting case, and as we've talked about, Pat, not only First Amendment cases are big at the Supreme Court this year, but they had the yacht case, which was tangentially related to fire insurance on a yacht. They have this case that has insurance flavor. And it's not often that you see insurance issues of any type or insurance
yeah,
even
not,
get mentioned.
Yeah, these are not obviously state law insurance issues. These
right.
are admiralty and bankruptcy related insurance issues, but they have an impact on insurance.
They do.
Insurance is pursuant to state law or federal law, rather, that the name of the statute escapes me always.
McCarran-Ferguson.
Thank you very much. That cedes that law to the states in order to avoid antitrust, because otherwise you can imagine the antitrust problems in insurance regulation. The states have a unique interest in making sure that the insurers are solvent, and they regulate them, shall we say, heavily,
right,
to ensure their solvency. I do a lot of work, as Dan does, for insurance companies. And yes, the regulations are substantial and they are tight. That's just how the work is done. So,
yep.
With that, we will turn to our BIPA, GIPA, IPA, BI. I think we did our BI the first segment there, Dan.
We did.
There was a Pennsylvania case that held in favor of the insurer. There's a case, or there's an article I'm going to post on GIPA that I sent Dan from the DRI publication for the defense on Illinois' GIPA that I'll post about this week. So take a look for that.
And I'll send you. I'll send you my article as well, Pat. I think I mentioned to you the Federation of Regulatory Counsel. I did a recent article, similar in many ways to the DRA article, just updating folks on kind of this law that's now being used to, or tried to be used for, to make news on a statute that talks about health insurance and is very clear. And in my article, I go into the Department of HIPAA regulations and other things as well to demonstrate that health plan means health plan and not life plans. But
that won't stop the plaintiff's bar from trying.
No. And the other thing I think before we move on from this segment, Pat, is the news that you talked about a lot of legislation. One bill that passed the House and now goes to the Senate, I think it's, or do I have it reversed, is
I think that, you had it reversed, but it doesn't matter.
Yeah, but it's the Biometric Information Privacy Act. There's an amendment that passed one of the chambers in Springfield that would indicate that for many of these BIPA cases where daily, eight times a day, where one employee uses their scan, only one scan would be the potential injury. So if you had 1,000 employees, you'd have 1,000 potential counts of violations. Questions probably here on retroactiveness and or how you implement that, or cases that are currently pending or that that have accrued, number one. Number two, we talked about Madigan. Pat mentioned ITLA. I think and again, we don't know what the outcomes will be, but expect that to be challenged on like when we've done tort reform and other things in this state of Illinois.
Well, right now, the case Martin versus Goodrich that we talked about on this is just the flip side. This is whose ox is being gored on due process. Can you change the nature of the damages?
Right.
Is that different from changing the nature of the statute of limitations? And this would, if passed, would plainly go to the Supreme Court. In the Martin versus Goodrich case, that's on certified questions from the Seventh Circuit, is going to be decided under the Illinois Due Process Clause. And if it comes out in favor of the plaintiffs in that case, that you can extend the statute of limitations, one would wonder is why would not sauce for the goose be sauce for the gander when it comes around to BIPA and limiting damages going forward on that. So if this passes, I will be very interested to see how the plaintiff's bar tries to distinguish that in the events that Goodrich. Likewise, I'll be interested to see how the defense bar try, if they win Goodrich, how they try to make the opposite argument. I'm not sure I see a difference, but far more intelligent and creative people than me will make arguments to try to have it be ways that I think are, frankly, in logically at least, are from the first blush, inconsistent. Maybe I'm wrong.
We may see some legal origami like we talked about back in the days of some of the BIPA cases at the federal and state levels, Pat, where defense was talking about, the damages aren't that great, right?
Yep.
Let's put it back in state and vice versa. And
the plaintiffs were arguing.
Not that big. Yeah, and the defense was like, wow, this is like $82 billion.
Exactly. Keep me in federal court.
Right. So, it'll be interesting to see how this all plays out. And again, for those that are not don't live in Illinois, it's never been a dull moment in my 57 years, for sure. Not that I was cognizant of it until much later in my adult life. But
it's never a dull moment when it comes to legal landscape here.
Never. Which
brings us to our prediction, sure to go wrong. We were 2-1 this week. Dan is 308, 63, and 24. I am 305, 66, and 24. Doe versus Fritsch, we discussed in episode 197, came out. We got this prediction right. It was about revenge porn. This poor woman had a sexually explicit video disclosed by the defendant, who got whacked with over $300,000 in compensatory and punitive damages. And the appellate court affirmed all of that. He had pled the fifth, and the court, you know, just because you plead the fifth doesn't mean that, yeah, you, there isn't an adverse inference that can be taken against you in civil court. But also the text messages that he sent her, all but admitting that he had sent these things. I don't know how else you could interpret those text messages other than I did it, or I caused it to be done. At the very least. So I don't understand, you know, the appellate court affirmed the decision of the trial court awarding these substantial damages. This woman went through an awful circumstance with what this person did to her. And he will not only face the civil penalties, but also criminal penalties, apparently.
And Pat, it's not going to be directly important, but I think one of the developing things that I'm seeing a lot of disclosures about is deep fakes with AI and porn and posts. There's some high school, I can't remember what state it is, where a lot of the high school boys were doing deep fakes of their classmates through artificial intelligence. And so cases like this, I think are going to, it's an important area, this revenge porn and the things that people are doing with the internet. And
It's pretty awful.
Yeah, pretty egregious.
Which brings us to King versus El Paricio del Pacifico from episode 193. This is the car through the Mexican restaurant case. And I have to say that I'm confused. I fail to understand why. There's a lot to say here. I'm going to have to be careful, though. Because I don't think much of the reasoning of this opinion, let's say.
No, I'm not quite as, you know, it doesn't have the burn that the first case we talked about today has to me, but it sure is, or the second case, but it sure as hell strikes me as bad decision. So I'll say that.
They argued duty. To a lesser extent, but they argued causation. And is it reasonably foreseeable that someone's going to drive the car through the front of the Mexican restaurant? And, you know, when you comply with the statute and all this, and they say, well, no, those are arguments about breach. Okay, argue breach next time, number one. Number two, which is kind of frustrating, but okay. But then we have the, is it foreseeable? And they're conflating the foreseeability analysis for duty and the foreseeability analysis for causation, which is exactly what was talked about at the oral argument. Yes, we get it. Under Burger King, flying cars are, you know, and not of the Back to the Future variety, cars that fly into Burger King's from Burger King versus Marshall are foreseeable. And apparently some person hitting the gas when they mean the brake and coming through the door and the wall of the restaurant hitting this poor plaintiff. Apparently that's foreseeable enough to support causation. There's no intervening cause. I don't understand how it just could merely set for how this isn't an intervening cause, which is a different element, a different prong of the causation element. Anyway. We got this one wrong. We said that it was going to get affirmed. It got reversed, which brings us to Fletcher versus Flynn all the way back on episode 174 from the 5th District. This is a legal malpractice case. Two lessons from this case that may have... Now, the defendant won, both at the trial level and on appeal. There's two things that would have made his life much easier. Number one, get an engagement letter, people. Get an engagement letter that sets forth the scope of what you're going to do, and more importantly, what you're not going to do, particularly in a transaction. In this case, he wasn't going to be responsible for the gas line. that the plaintiff was going to take care of the gas line. The client's going to take care of the gas line. Wasn't in there. Number two, when you tell your client something that's important and you give them a piece of advice and you let them choose as to what they want to do, write it down. Send them an email. Memorialize the conversation. Yes, it might come across as a CYA. Sure. Because that's what it is. Sometimes you have to cover your ass. And if the lawyer had done, now in this case, the jury believed the lawyer and didn't believe the plaintiff, that the plaintiff had not been counseled by the lawyer about incorporating his business in order to protect from personal liability. Fine. The jury believed him. But wouldn't this have been much easier if he had an email that said, I counsel you to incorporate your entity or LLC. I can provide those services. This is what it'll cost. Tell me what you want to do. That would have been summary judgment material if he had such an email, but he didn't. Write stuff down, write stuff down, write stuff down. I had a case recently representing a lawyer where she got a discount of half of her deductible merely because she had an engagement letter. Good job. Just having the engagement letter, she sent it to the adjuster, just said, all right, your deductible's cut in half. Wasn't a ton of money, but it sure was. It was better than a stick in the eye, simply because she took the good practice of having an engagement letter. Now, I think in this case, he had an engagement letter, just wasn't a very good one. And so he needed to be more clear. You can narrow your scope. Take full advantage of those kinds of issues. Dan, thoughts on that case?
I agree with you, Pat. Not again to defend this, but oftentimes with corporate clients on the non-litigation side, it can be difficult to do this, to be way specific because things change and nature of the engagement. But I agree with you. Write it down, and especially when you've given options. Again, having a phone call or something is not enough. I think the best practice is to say, we discussed the following, here's your options, here's the benefits and risk, and, after discussion, we understand that you've chosen X or Y or Z, right?
Right. So, and that also goes into the billing entry. I'll put in the billing entry, discussed with client, X, Y, Z. So I have in the billing entry that I do contemporaneously. So if it ever became an issue, if I lost the email or I didn't write the email because I was being a dumbass that day, at least I have the billing entry that sets forth what we talked about.
Yeah, be as specific as possible. I agree.
So with that, that brings us to our prediction. Sure, go wrong this week. We're only going to have two. I think the California Supreme Court is going to find in favor of the insurer. I'm not sure if that's I think they're going to answer the certified question. In the negative. Do you agree with that?
I think that's right. Okay. Based on the hearing and based on, I think that's right.
And then I think in Kaiser Gypsum, I think that's going to be a reversal.
I think it's a reversal. And, I don't know what the numbers will be, but like I said, if you listen to oral arguments, many of the justices seemed very skeptical of this argument that the insurer doesn't have any interest or somehow can't intervene. And again, I think one of the lessons from here, if that's how it does come out, is we've talked about this too, Pat. I think you have to know when to give a little bit or concede a little bit, and not be always uber strident in your positions.
And he was strident.
He was like, no matter what they asked them, they said, pretty much he was saying that they would, there might be some point where they could maybe get in, but there was no conceivable way that they'd ever be able to have an opportunity to be heard. So
that's right. Which brings us to the rule of the week. Dan, why don't you introduce that?
Sure. And you talked about, Pat, you mentioned it briefly, but there's a new rule that was approved by one of the judicial conference committees. About case management in MDL, the full text of the group that met is 800 something pages. Not all of it's with respect necessarily to MDL, but Pat, why don't you tell us a little more about this new rule that's been in the works, I think, for 7 years or maybe even more?
Yeah, 7 years. As we mentioned, MDLs now make up nearly between somewhere between 70 to 80% of the federal docket, which is a near double of where they were in 2019. It's a shocking amount. And they're rife for abuse because there, despite the size of the docket, there is no rule currently in the federal rules that specifically addresses how to handle an MDL. Nothing. They just are dealt with like the rest of the rules, and they're not like the rest of the cases. There are thousands, hundreds, if not thousands of cases gathered together from all over the country with lead counsel in front of one judge who has to deal with these cases both as a collective and as well as individually. It's a complex, complex piece of litigation. And so the proposal is, frankly, very weak tea to try to, it's a series of suggestions as to what the court is supposed to do. Much of it dealing with who's going to lead, how you have to figure out who leadership counsel is, which is important, obviously, but can we please get down to actually having some real protections to figure out if any of these claims are legit, because so many of them appear, many cases, not to be. Now, some are, obviously. There's some that are real, but many are not. And this rule doesn't seem to really provide that mechanism. Defendants we're hoping to get some more robust protections, but this process continues. It goes from this committee to another committee. Who knows how long that'll take. So in the meantime, the process churns on. So as I said, I'm writing about that in my column this week, because you can't really talk about civil procedure in this country without talking about MDLs on occasion. It's such a big part of the litigation landscape. Dan, anything to add on that?
No, I think you covered it, and yeah, it's and I think this has to now go to some other committee or something, if I read it right. So this
it's a long process to get the federal rules amended.
It is, and by the time they do it, the landscape will have probably changed, and it'll be some irrelevant stuff again. But in any event, like you said, it's small baby steps and little tiny changes. So we'll see.
So with that, we'll take our leave and see everybody next week on the Podium and Panel Podcast.
I'm Dan Cotter, and on behalf of my co-host, Pat Eckler, we thank you for listening and look forward to having you join us again. Please follow us on LinkedIn and read our columns in the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin. Please join us again at the Podium and Panel. Each episode on the Podium and Panel Podcast, we will cover several oral arguments and decisions in civil matters at the Illinois Appellate Court and Illinois Supreme Court, with the occasional coverage of SCOTUS and other appellate courts. The purpose of the podcast is to inform of developments that may affect business and are not to be considered legal advice. They do not create a lawyer-client relationship. Information on previous case results do not guarantee a similar future result. The opinions are their own and do not reflect those of the firms for which they work or their clients.